There you are. Would you stand so we can all recognize you? You may be seated, and thank you for coming. The Court with Class program is co-sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. In all high school students across the state are invited to come to Madison and listen to an oral argument. And they're given materials, which I'm sure you all had, and you may do some work in class on the particular case. And if you can, and unfortunately you cannot, we would have a presentation for you at noon with a justice. But neither you nor the earlier group is able to stay. This is we're very proud of this program. It's part of our outreach program where we try to tell people about the court system, the least known and least understood branch of our government. And I'm also happy to say in a recent exhibition that we've had of the court's 150th anniversary, we were founded in 1853. We have won a national award for that exhibit, and that exhibit was directed by Justice Bradley. So we're pleased with that, and we invite you to check our internet and our various other outreach programs and publications. Well, we've met you. Now let me introduce the court to you. Starting on my far left is our newest justice, a Justice Patience Rogensack, but she's not there. That's what they're trying to tell me. And she's not there because she is not participating in this case. So it's an empty seat. Seated next to the empty seat is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right is Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right is Justice Diane Sykes. With these introductions made, I will call this second case 01-0509CR, State v. Corey J. Hampton. Representing the state of Wisconsin, is Assistant Attorney General Jennifer Nashold. Ms. Nashold.
Thank you. May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Jennifer Nashold, and I represent the state of Wisconsin in this matter. This case involves two issues. The first is whether a circuit court has to itself tell a defendant at a plea colloquy that it is not bound by the sentencing recommendations that were negotiated, or whether it may ascertain a defendant's understanding of that information in the same way that it determines a defendant's understanding of almost all other significant consequences of a guilty plea. The second issue is whether a circuit court may deny without an evidentiary hearing a motion for plea withdrawal where the record conclusively demonstrates that the defendant is not entitled to relief because the defendant has only made a conclusory allegation that he did not understand the information that was omitted by the circuit court. With regard to the first issue, the Court of Appeals in this case determined that under State v. Gray, a circuit court must itself tell a defendant it is not bound by sentencing recommendations that were negotiated pursuant to a plea negotiation. It is not sufficient under the Court of Appeals decision in this case for a circuit court to ascertain this information and determine that the defendant has been given this information through other avenues, such as communications with his attorney or prior proceedings in a courtroom or various other ways in which a defendant may be apprised of information. In other words, it is a deficient plea colloquy where a court fails to give this information itself to a defendant. The Court of Appeals' decision is incorrect for five primary reasons. First of all, it was not constrained by Gray and its progeny to reach this decision. As stated in the state's brief in this case, Gray, Comstock, and McQuay did not specifically address the issue that is being addressed in this case, namely whether a court has to specifically provide this information. Any indication that a court must personally do this was dicta in those cases. Furthermore, even if it was not dicta, the court has never stated that that the circuit court must personally give this information itself to a defendant. That language is never used. What Gray states is that the circuit court must advise a defendant personally. In addition, as stated, this holding is inconsistent with the way in which other important rights may be ascertained in a plea colloquy. And there is no reason to elevate this particular information over other information that a defendant must be made aware of at a plea colloquy. And one thing that I didn't emphasize in my brief probably sufficiently is that it's the state's position that it doesn't even necessarily achieve the goals or further the interests of a defendant in the way that perhaps the Court of Appeals assumed. As the Court of Appeals mentioned in another case, Mordendorfer, it's not necessarily true that a circuit court delivering certain information is going to be understood or absorbed any more readily, and perhaps less so, than if the information is given to a defendant by that defendant's attorney in the non-high-pressure setting of the attorney's office, and where a defendant is able to take time with the attorney and to go over the information and ask questions with the attorney. Finally, even if the court itself must deliver this information, if this court holds that Gray, the language from Gray is not dicta and that it requires the court to personally give this information to a defendant, the state submits that this was done in this case by the circuit court repeatedly stating that the prosecutor's sentencing recommendation was nothing more than a recommendation, and by the court's repeatedly telling the defendant what the maximum penalties were in this case. I'll go over.
You're not relying on the language in the, that appears in the appendix where it says what the state's recommendation will be. That is, the trial court says that and then says, but the sentence is not, but the court isn't bound by it. I'm looking at page 145 of the appendix, lines 13 and 14.
That's correct.
You're not relying on that language. Maybe you're not relying on it because he's only telling about the choices that the state gave.
Right, that's how I read that. And I believe that's how the Court of Appeals read that language as well.
Okay. Ms. Nashhold, let me ask you this. We've got a system in Wisconsin, as you know, where the trial judge is not involved in the plea negotiations. The trial judge in some states is directly involved. That's not true in Wisconsin. We've said that it's not the judge's role to be involved in plea negotiations.
That's right.
Given that situation, what is wrong with explaining that directly to the defendant? Why is the state opposed to that?
The state is not opposed to a court giving that information. The state is opposed to having that be a requirement and stating that it's a deficient plea colloquy or a deficient plea if that court is not, or if that information is not given directly by the court.
It's hardly a difficult requirement to say to a judge, you've got to look the defendant in the eye and say, look, I wasn't involved in the plea negotiations here, therefore I don't have to follow the recommendation coming from the prosecutor, from your attorney, or from anybody else, including from a pre-sentence report. Do you understand that? That doesn't take very long. It's right on point with the way our system works in Wisconsin. Why shouldn't that be a requirement?
This court has already rejected that notion in Bangert and many other cases with regard to other important rights. With other important rights or with other important information, including the elements of the offense, certain constitutional rights that are waived by pleading guilty, the maximum sentence that could be imposed, all of that information is not required to be given out of the trial court's mouth. And yes, in an ideal world, the defendant's attorney would not only explain this to the defendant, but also the court would reiterate that as well. But this court has stated that it's not a requirement that a court give this information itself, and you could certainly make those same arguments for any one of those rights. That
I don't understand how you can read Gray and McQuay and Comstock and say that we have not told trial judges that they're supposed to personally have this colloquy with the defendant. Now, you said it's dicta. We've said in a number of cases what we say is not dicta. What we say in every single case is important. How can this be dicta?
Well, as I stated in my brief, the issue in Gray was whether a manifest injustice occurred when the circuit court, whether a plea was valid where the defendant was made a deal in exchange for charges being dismissed against the defendant's brother. And this court stated that it was hampered by the fact that it did not have the plea agreement in front of it, and then proceeded to quote a large chunk of the ABA standards, and included in that chunk of quote was this requirement that a court advise the defendant that it is not bound by the sentencing recommendation. It wasn't essential to the court's decision, and it did not say that the circuit court must do it itself.
Didn't we make it clear that we were adopting the ABA standards?
I'm not sure whether that decision adopts the standards or cites with approval, but that particular language, the language that the Court of Appeals relied on in this case, was not essential to the court's holding, and this court did not intentionally take up that particular issue in the case. It just wasn't argued, and there was no need for the court to address it. And the same was true in McQuay and in Comstock.
Let me ask you this. What difference does it make? Suppose we say that this is required, and it has to be on the record in open court, personally by the court to the defendant. So the court does not do it. The trial court does not do it. Mistake, unintentional, overlooked. Okay? It's not an automatic reversal. It's not an automatic, you are now allowed to withdraw your plea.
That's right.
So if it's a requirement and the trial court does not do it, then you'd move into the second issue of this case is, do you need an evidentiary hearing before you withdraw the plea, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, let us suppose it is not required that it is done personally in open court. And let us say there isn't a plea questionnaire, so there is nothing on the record that this defendant knew that the court's not bound by the plea agreement.
Okay.
What happens then? Is there an automatic reversal?
And the defendant has alleged that...
And alleged he didn't know.
With sufficient particularity, or if we need to address
Nobody
that.
Nobody ever told me. I've met with my lawyers 20 times. No one ever told me.
If there's nothing else on the record, then I would think that it would be a deficient plea colloquy.
Would you have an evidentiary hearing to find out if he's lying in his statement that the lawyer didn't tell him, and bring in the lawyer, and the lawyer says, I did tell him.
Yes.
20 times we met. So if it's required and the record's deficient, you have a hearing. If it's not required and the record is deficient, you have a hearing. So now we have the case here where it's not on the record that the judge tells him. Judge doesn't say. We have the plea questionnaire which says, I understand that this element of judge isn't found. If it's not required, do you have a hearing? I'm trying to find out what the devil difference this is going to make at the bottom line.
Well, it depends. Does it make a difference to me personally?
I want to know what makes a difference.
It makes a difference, I think, for the circuit courts. I think they're very interested in this case. It makes a difference for prosecutors.
What difference does it make, regardless of how this is done, in the bottom line of, in no case does he automatically get a withdrawal of the plea? So the only issue is whether he gets an evidentiary hearing. Is that right?
That is right. That's what this case is about, whether he gets an evidentiary hearing. But I think that the Court of Appeals decision was perhaps too cavalier in discussing what it means to have an evidentiary hearing. The Court does mention the overworked circuit courts and the fact that this will be, you know, onerous on the circuit courts, but it said that it wasn't in a position to change what it viewed as a gray requirement. But, you know, there's other considerations as well. When there is an evidentiary hearing, a defendant presumably has to get transported to the courtroom from the jail or prison or wherever. And if the record conclusively demonstrates that a defendant was not denied his rights, then what is the point of this? And why is it so difficult for a defendant to allege with particularity in a motion, assuming that it's meritorious, what the grounds are and why it was deficient and how and why the defendant did not know this information?
What can he say other than I didn't understand it? Yes, I signed the plea questionnaire. Yes, I said I understood it. But he didn't. What more particular thing can he say?
Defendant could say, for example, that, yes, I signed this plea questionnaire. As we were going through it, my attorney kept telling me, I know this judge. I know what the judge will impose. I've been in front of this judge a million times, and the judge will follow the prosecutor's recommendation. A defendant could say, on my way to the hearing, I was in a car accident. I suffered brain trauma. I wasn't aware of what was going on in the courtroom that day, or on my way to the attorney's office when I signed the plea questionnaire. There are circumstances, and the state is not saying that a plea questionnaire solves it conclusively. The state is not going as far as the circuit court in this case. But where there is nothing more than simply a bald allegation, as the Court of Appeals phrases it, that I didn't understand, when everything in the record thus far demonstrates otherwise, then that is insufficient to give the defendant a hearing. And it may vary from case to case in terms of how much interaction a circuit court is required to have with a defendant. In this case, the defendant had 6 years of college education, 2 college degrees, and I think sort of implicit in the colloquy that the court engaged in with the defendant is this understanding on behalf of the court that the defendant was aware of what was going on. The defendant signed the plea questionnaire 2 days before coming into the courtroom. This wasn't a situation where a defendant got up and said, I didn't do the crime, and the defendant's attorney whispers in the defendant's ears. They go off to a corner, and he starts signing this plea questionnaire and is up in front of the court pleading guilty 5 minutes later. This was a situation where presumably the well-educated defendant who was able to spend enough time with his attorney, according to his own statement in court, made an informed decision and was informed that the prosecutor's recommendation was solely a recommendation and did not bind the court in any way. This is in conjunction with being told of the maximum penalties twice in court.
What elements does the judge have to personally say on the open record in court that will be a per se permission to withdraw the plea?
I'm sorry, that would be a per se what?
Per se, that the trial court has to allow withdrawal of a plea.
The only situation I'm aware of and that the Court of Appeals mentioned was the situation in Duang-Malia. Is that what you're asking? What information entitles a defendant to an automatic plea withdrawal? And those that situation was very, very specific.
So if the judge, let's exclude that and say this is not an alien. So if the judge doesn't say anything at a plea, here, a colloquy, is that good enough?
No. I would state that it's not.
That's a per se reversal, a per se withdrawal of a plea.
Oh, per se withdrawal?
That's what this case is about, isn't it?
This case is about whether an evidentiary hearing is required. I suppose if a trial court didn't say anything and just relied on the information in the advisory form, this court might want to have that be another per se rule. But, you know, the statute, 97108, basically says that there has to be an addressing of the defendant personally. You can't just ignore the defendant in the courtroom. You have to address the defendant personally, and then you have to determine whether the defendant understands the nature of the plea, the maximum sentence, and the same thing is true with other information that a defendant is entitled to be given. So I think that statute and other and the Bangert decisions require some sort of colloquy between the defendant and the court. It's not enough for the court to walk in and say, thanks for the advisory form, plea is accepted. And that's all the state is requesting in this case, is that this court apply the same standards that it has in all other instances, with the exception of deportation consequences, and say that it's enough. If you talk to the defendant personally and you ascertain that the defendant understands this information, that is sufficient. And like I said, if we're dealing with a defendant that is particularly young or does not seem to be on the ball, or if the defendant states, wait, you can why are you telling me the maximum sentence? You can impose the maximum sentence, or there's anything like that, then yes, a circuit court would be required to go into that in more detail. But on this record, there's just nothing indicating that the circuit court was required to do that.
He has serious mental health issues.
The defendant in this case?
Yes,
but it was also stated by the defendant that he was taking his medications as prescribed by his doctor. There's nothing indicating that that wasn't under control.
Indicating that he didn't really understand what the maximum sentence was.
Right. He states that, and that indicates that where he does have questions, he asks the court about that.
I'm sorry we've spent this amount of time, because I think the much more difficult issue, since we agree whether it's required or not, may not make any difference.
That's right. My yellow light is on, so if you want me to move to that issue, I will. Okay. The second issue basically involves this court's reconciliation of a couple lines of cases, the Bangert line of cases and the Bentley, Levesque, Nelson line of cases. And I think the way to do that in this case is to say that a defendant must do more than make a conclusory allegation that he did not understand, that there has to be something in the affidavit or motion that shows the court why the defendant didn't understand. And that's what this court did in Levesque. Even if this court wants to hold that Hampton is distinguishable because it involved a ineffective assistance claim, we still have Levesque, and it's still good law. And the court stated that with regard to this particular issue, a defendant's understanding in Levesque. In Levesque, the defendant said, I had mental problems and a mental defect, and therefore I didn't understand. And this court said that's not enough. That's not enough to get you an evidentiary hearing. And this court should simply follow its precedent in Levesque. And even though that case was prior to Bangert, this court should read that into a defendant's burden in making a sufficient allegation that he did not understand the omitted information. And if you look at other cases by this court, I think Bolig or there are other cases where this court has used the phrase properly allege. And I think that the way to properly allege is to provide more than I didn't understand, especially when there's information in the record that shows that you did understand.
Well, can you reconcile Bangert and Bentley? I mean, Bangert talks about a prima facie case, production of evidence, shifting the burden to the state. Bentley does not talk that language. Bentley talks, in effect, the burden is on the defendant to prove, and Bentley was ineffective assistance of counsel.
I think that the only way to reconcile those cases is to say that it has to be more than a bald allegation. And even the Court of Appeals decision in this case says that there's nothing irreconcilable about Levesque and the burden-shifting framework, but then for reasons that I'm not able to understand says that we can't apply Levesque in light of Bangert. And I don't think it changes the burden of production. I don't think that Bangert changes the burden of production in the sense that it's still requiring the defendant to allege that he didn't understand, but that you have to take all of this court's precedent in its entirety, and that the way to do that and the way to reconcile these cases is to require a defendant to make more than an allegation, just as the defendant must do in looking at the first component of whether he's met his prima facie case. You can't just say there was a defective plea colloquy. You have to show how it was defective, and the same should be true for the second component of the prima facie case.
What about, what does the defendant have to show, that he didn't understand the, that the trial court had unfettered right to a sentence without considering the plea agreement or without being bound by the plea agreement? Or does the defendant have to show that he would have not pled had he known that?
I think the former, that that the defendant didn't know this and for the defendant to state why. I think that is consistent with Bangert.
He has to explain why he didn't understand it, and that would be good enough. He doesn't have to go the next step and say he wouldn't have pled guilty.
I don't believe so. And
so then what happens? He says this, and he says it's because I was in a hurry. That's why I signed the questionnaire. One of the reasons you gave. Must the defendant under Bentley, must the defendant get an evidentiary hearing?
I think if the defendant, under the facts of this case, if the defendant had just said, I was in a hurry, that probably would not be sufficient. I mean, this is for
3 minutes while we were in court.
Oh, okay.
A recess. I want to take one of your examples, which you think is okay. Is that, does he absolutely entitled to an evidentiary hearing?
And there was nothing else on the record with the court saying this is the maximum penalty, and then depending on the, well, I would say that if there's nothing else, then yes, an evidentiary hearing should be held.
Must be held.
Must be held.
Okay. And what short of that would give him a discretionary right? Under Bentley, under certain circumstances mandatory, other circumstances discretionary. So, what?
I think in a situation like this, where you've got this plea questionnaire that says that specifically recites this information to the defendant, the attorney has stated in the plea questionnaire through his signature, her signature, that the defendant understood each particular item, and where the defendant signed it and stated that he understood that information, then I think there has to be something that contradicts that, that basically, despite this information, despite the fact that I engaged in this colloquy with the court where it advised me of the maximum sentence and used the term recommendation and talked about the plea questionnaire, that there was something outside that that begs for a credibility determination to be made by the circuit court. And that could be my defense attorney was telling me otherwise, that the prosecutor was telling me otherwise, that there has to be something else to contradict that information.
You'd apply the same standard whether it was mandated that the trial court do a personal colloquy on this issue or whether it's merely good practice.
Yes. I see my time is up. If there are no further questions, I will sit down.
Thank you, Ms. Nashold. You've got 5 minutes in rebuttal. Melinda Swartz, Assistant State Public Defender, representing Mr. Hampton.
May it please the Court, Counsel, Your Honors, I am Melinda Swartz. I represent the defendant appellant, Corey Hampton, in this case. I'm here today to ask this Court to affirm the Court of Appeals decision, which remanded this case for an evidentiary hearing on defendant's motion. On this record, with a mentally ill defendant who has no prior criminal record in a case where there's taking of an Alford plea, where the Court twice recited the terms of the plea bargain, which were confusing, and also where there were two alternatives. Either the defendant could request or could select that the state would recommend 7 years imposed in state and 7 years probation, or it would leave the disposition, well, it would be probation with some time imposed in state, with the disposition up to the court's discretion. That, combined with the fact that the court never told the defendant that it was not bound by the sentencing recommendation or the state sentencing recommendation and the defendant's post-conviction motion allegation that he did not understand that the plea agreement was not binding on the court, required an evidentiary hearing in this case. Under the Bangert framework, the defendant must prove two things as a prima facie case before the burden shifts to the state. That is a deficient colloquy, and he also has to claim that he didn't understand. In a burden-shifting scheme under Bangert, then the burden of proof switches to the state. The reason that this court stated in Bangert that the burden shifts to the state is because the state has the responsibility to assist the court in making sure that the plea is knowingly and voluntarily taken. There are three ways that this colloquy is deficient. All of those involve the court's failure to inform the defendant that it was not bound by the plea agreement. There's three aspects to it, but they all are basically the same thing, that the court was mandated to had a mandatory duty under White, Comstock, McQuay, and Melby mentions this per se requirement that the court inform the defendant that it is not bound by the plea agreement. Now, there, and as the Chief Justice is correct, the fact that the person is, or this court has imposed a mandatory duty, does not mean that it's per se entitled to either an evidentiary hearing or per se entitled to withdraw a plea. Okay? The question is that the court must tell the person this, and it's not automatic grounds for plea withdrawal if the court doesn't do it, because the next question would be, did the person understand or not? And the person has to also properly allege that he didn't understand that information. Or the state, at the plea hearing, when it noticed that the court does not tell the person that it's not bound by the plea agreement, the state could, and I've seen this happen, where the state prosecutors will actually engage in a colloquy with the defendant and will ask the defendant, do you understand this? Do you understand this? To sort of assist the court in making that decision. Or, as in the state's hypothetical, which is at the beginning of the brief, the defendant says, I understand that you're not bound by the plea agreement. In that situation, that would not constitute a deficient colloquy. Now, there are good policy reasons behind this Court's mandate that a person has to be informed directly by the Court that it is not bound by the plea agreement. And I set some of those policy reasons out in my brief. But I think that it's what the Court what's really important is it's to preserve the integrity and the fairness of the plea negotiation and the plea bargaining system in the State. And I believe in the SM32 at footnotes 10 and 11, the committee who prepares the SM32 talks about how this is required because the Court is first not an active participant in the plea bargain. And that has to be made directly to the defendant. That information must come from the judge. And the second thing is because the Court has an independence in sentencing. And as this Court said recently in Adrian Williams, where the defense had asked for a rule that would allow a person the opportunity to withdraw the plea bargain if the Court, at the taking of the plea, had indicated they were not inclined to follow the sentencing recommendation, this Court indicated that that rule wasn't necessary because the defendant must be informed of and must understand that the Court was not bound in any way by the negotiated sentencing recommendation.
And you're arguing hard that we should mandate this colloquy. And
I think the Court already has mandated
okay.
it.
Retain it. All right. The cases could date back to the 70s, and maybe the Court since then has gotten wiser or not wiser. Whichever way you view it should go. But my question to you is the same. What difference does it make if we mandate the colloquy or we don't mandate the colloquy? We mandate the colloquy, it's not an automatic withdrawal of plea. It's not an automatic evidentiary hearing, right?
Right.
If we don't mandate it, then what happens?
Then the concern would be that there would be more evidentiary hearings. That the we have to mandate it, or the rule has to be continued, so that the person, the defendant, knows from the judge that the plea bargain is not binding.
I know, but if the judge doesn't say it, and we mm-hmm. don't say it's required, but that it's good enough if it's done on the questionnaire, or if it's good enough if it's done by the attorney outside of court, what difference does it make? You still don't have an automatic withdrawal, and you still don't have an automatic evidentiary hearing.
Right, but that goes to the second issue.
I know, but my point of the matter is, if it doesn't make any difference in the bottom line as to what happens, why do we care? Why are you fighting so hard if it's not going to matter to your client, ultimately, one way or another?
And I guess I'm saying to my client, on this record, he's entitled to a hearing, but I do think that it's important that that rule be continued for all clients. But for my client, based on the record that's before the Court, and that was really my second reason,
right.
that...
It's important because of fairness and integrity. I'll go along with that, but does it matter? The bottom line as to whether he gets a hearing?
No, I don't believe so, because I believe that this colloquy was defective, and I believe that he properly alleged that he was not that the Court was not bound by the plea agreement, that he didn't understand it.
Maybe putting it another way, does it render the plea involuntary or unknowing if the defendant shows at the evidentiary hearing that, in fact, he did not know this information?
Yes, it does. It renders the plea involuntary and not knowing if he proves that at the evidentiary hearing. If the Court finds that, after conducting an evidentiary hearing on this case, if the Circuit Court finds that he did not understand that information, it would render his plea involuntary.
Doesn't he have to show that it made a difference in his decision to plead?
Does not.
Why not?
Under State versus Bartell. There's no requirement that he actually show prejudice. The question is, did under a due process analysis, the question is whether it was knowing and voluntary, not whether it caused him to enter his plea. That one thing.
So if he thinks that the judge is going to give what the State recommends and then so pleads, but then finds out the judge is going to give more, because you're not going to get this case if he gets less. Gives more, then you're saying it wasn't knowing and voluntary because a basic condition of the plea has now been removed. I mean, that's the line of your argument.
Right, but he has to know and understand.
Right, but it doesn't matter whether it's mandated in the colloquy or not mandated in the colloquy.
I believe that he has to understand that information. Right. So, and in this case where the court recited it and he didn't tell it. And I also think that that's part of the cornerstone for this court's rejection of the rule in State Adrian Williams, that there's a requirement that he understands it. So it also has a voluntariness dynamic through the Constitution. And so I think that based on this record, with the deficient colloquy and they allege that he did not understand, that there's a prima facie showing. And the Court of Appeals was correct on this record for remanding this case for an evidentiary hearing before the circuit court.
Counsel, I just want to follow up briefly to make sure I understand whether or not if the law is that you have to give it personally and the judge did not and there's a defective hearing and there's an allegation he didn't understand that information, won't that in most cases then result in an evidentiary hearing as to whether or not State can meet its burden that the plea was knowing and voluntarily made?
Not necessarily. I mean, if the defendant, in fact, understood that information.
Well, that's why I couched my question in most cases. I mean, there might be in some situations where it is overt on the record that even though the judge did not personally inform the defendant of that, the defendant knew it. But it seems to me that in most cases it won't be so overtly stated on the record and that that will result in a hearing.
As an attorney, I mean, the client also has to tell, the person has to tell their post-conviction attorney that they didn't, in fact, understand. They did not understand that the plea wasn't binding. I mean, this is a very rare case for this to come to the court. I mean, it's very rare that either the court doesn't tell the defendant or the State does not make a record of that, or that, in fact, the person did not understand that that it was not binding. So I would say that it's a very rare case for that to result. And I don't think it would result in that many.
I don't think it necessarily will result in that many hearings, but I think that if the defendant established the prima facie case in those slice, that small slice of situations, that it would most likely result in an evidentiary hearing. I mean, maybe we're just disagreeing about nothing.
Well, and, I mean, I guess that if and in my opinion is, this is, the court's already mandated this. This has been mandated for 30 years, and I don't know how often that really happens. I mean, so in my experience, this is one of the first times I've actually ever seen a court not tell a person that it wasn't bound by the plea agreement. So I think that the system's worked very well for the past 30 years, and I don't think that the law needs to be changed at all. So I guess that's what I'm trying to say with regard to that.
But the law needs to be clarified with regard to the tension between Bentley and Bangert, doesn't it?
I don't believe so. I believe that in Bangert, this Court stated exactly why the Bangert pleading requirements are the way that they are. The Court said that it was a due process violation, and it was a burden shifting analysis, and that the State has responsibility to assist the Court in making sure that a person's due process rights to enter a knowing and voluntarily and intelligent plea, those are on the State. And so the State has to assist the Court, and that's why this Court said that it was going to be doing a burden shifting analysis, so that the defendant has to show a knowing and or a defective colloquy and allege that he didn't understand something. And the ultimate issue, this is something that I dispute with the State, it's not going to be maybe there will be some credibility determinations, but the ultimate issue is going to be, did he understand? Not why didn't he understand, which might be relevant at the evidentiary hearing, but the ultimate issue for the court to decide is, did he or did he not understand? And so in that regard, I don't really think that there's a tension between Bangert and Bentley in this context, because Bentley is not a burden-shifting scheme. The relationship that Bentley has to this case, and I said this in my brief, is that it's that he has to allege specific facts. And in this case, Mr. Hampton did. I mean, he alleged, and I'm going to refer to the post-conviction motion and the appendix. He alleged that he did not understand. That is a statement of fact. It's not conclusory. He stated, and I'm going to quote from it, that at the time he entered his Alford plea, he did not know that the court was not bound by the state's recommendation and was free to sentence him to whatever sentence it deemed appropriate. That's a statement of fact.
As I understand the state's argument on that point, though, it's that there must be an allegation of some evidentiary facts, not just the ultimate fact of lack of understanding before you get a hearing. I think that was the thrust of the dissent in the Court of Appeals, is that the prima facie case has to be made by the assertion of some what we would call evidentiary facts as opposed to the ultimate fact, I didn't understand.
Okay.
That's how I understand
the
state's argument.
All right. Then I would continue that also in his affidavit. I mean, he said in the affidavit attached to his post-conviction motion, he entered his plea even though he did not commit the offense because he believed that the offer of 7 years imposed and stayed with the probation was a good offer, given his belief that the maximum possible penalty was 40 years and that the court could not impose a sentence higher than 7 years if he chose that alternative from the state's recommendation. And I would also say that that is a statement of fact. That's his explanation of what he understood, which I think is more than he has to do under Bangert, and in fact would comply with Bentley because it also explains why he did it. So I think on those grounds, I don't think that I actually think that the affidavit that was attached to his motion was more than he had to prove and more than he needed to allege, and I think that he's entitled to his hearing on these facts. Does that answer your question? Okay. And then I also just want to just briefly address just a couple of the things that the state pointed to. And one of the things that the state relies on is this guilty plea questionnaire. And I would just like to point out to the court that the state is relying on this guilty plea questionnaire to saying that this conclusively proves that he understood that the court was not bound to follow any plea agreement, which is contained in item number 10 on the guilty plea questionnaire, which is record number 8 in this court. But in that very same paragraph underneath, it says, I understand that the judge is free to sentence me to the following minimum and maximum possible penalties. And then it lists the offense, second-degree sexual assault, and it says the years, 20 and 10. And if you recall, during the plea colloquy, the defendant stated that he did not understand that the maximum was 20. He believed that the maximum was 40. So given that he did not understand information that is actually contained in the very same paragraph that the state is trying to rely on, that's another reason why, on the facts of this case, he is entitled to an evidentiary hearing. And I just want to briefly, and this will be the last point, unless there's going to be any other questions that I want to make, is that on this record, I do not believe that one of the things that concerns me about this record and I would like to draw the court's attention to is also that the fact is that one of the arguments that the state is relying on is that he spent spent enough time with his attorney. And my concern about that is if you look at the record and you actually read some of the questions and some of the statements between the court and counsel, and at one point counsel even has to explain to the defendant what jail means as opposed to incarceration, plus the fact that they had to go off the record because, in fact, the attorney had not reviewed with his client an Alford plea, that we cannot rely on the fact that the client discussed this case with his attorney to convey that information to the court. And are there any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Nashold.
Uh,
I think a comparison of this case and Dwang Malia is very useful in this case to just show why this particular information should not be elevated over other information that a defendant is required to be given at a plea hearing. Dwang Malia involved a statutory right to be informed of deportation consequences, even despite the fact that this was mandated by statute. The state argued in that case that it's sufficient if the defendant understands that information. This court was guided by the fact that the information contained in the statute was in quotation marks. It basically said the court must say this particular information. In addition, in that case, this court noted that the plea had to be vacated if a defendant showed three things. And those three things were that, I believe, that he had a likelihood of deportation as a result of his plea, that the trial court did not give this information, and I'm sorry, the third thing escapes me, but anyway, it was met in that case. And so there was a specific statute not only saying what a court must state to a defendant, but also that the plea must be vacated. And these circumstances, and there was legislative history to support that the legislature meant exactly what it said in that statute. And we just don't have that here. We have basically some, what I regard, and I assume Justice Kirk disagrees with me, as some loose language in Gray and some cases quoting Gray that states that this information is required to be given by the court. And what that means to be advised or to be advised of personally is a matter that this court must also determine.
Do you agree if the defendant should prove, or the state should not be able to dissuade us, that if it is proved that the defendant did not know that the trial court was not bound by the agreement, and that the defendant would not have fled but for the fact that he relied on the trial court not giving excess of what the state recommended, that was not a knowing involuntary plea? Assuming that there's perfect proof.
I believe that it would. And I think, as I stated in my brief, that is subsumed in the notion that a defendant must, for example, be given information regarding maximum penalties. And I think there is precedent to support that idea that it would be an unknowing plea. I'm not going to dispute that. With regard to the second issue in this case, the state's position is that the Court of Appeals, the majority decision in this case, simply writes Levesque, Nelson, and Bentley out of existence, that those cases were very clear that you cannot have a bald allegation, even concerning the allegation that you did not understand, and hope to supplement that at an evidentiary hearing. It is simply insufficient. Levesque is still good law. It was relied on in Bentley, which was a post-Bangert case.
Counsel, how do you respond to your opposing counsel's assertion that the affidavit of post-conviction does meet the mandates of Bentley? Set aside Bangert discussion for a moment, that it sets forth with sufficient particularity had he known that the court was not bound by the state's recommendation, he would not have pled guilty but would have asserted his right to a jury trial, that he entered his plea even though he did not commit the offense because he believed that the offer of 7 years imposed and stayed with probation was a good offer given his belief that the maximum was 40 and the court could not impose a sentence higher than 7 years if he chose that alternative recommendation. He indicates that at the beginning of the plea hearing he believed that the maximum sentence was 40 and he did not understand the maximum possible sentence was, at the beginning of his plea hearing he believed that the maximum possible sentence was 40 years in Wisconsin State Prison. He did not understand that the maximum possible sentence was 40 years until the court explained it to him during the plea hearing,
My response is threefold. First, the Court of Appeals decision assumes that it was nothing more than a bald allegation, and that's the decision that this court is reviewing. And the Court of Appeals uses that language, says that it is okay if it is conclusory, that this is conclusory and that's okay, that's all the defendant has to do. And interestingly, the second point is that the defendant pled guilty for at least four reasons that were stated in the state's brief, that didn't want to put the victim through the trauma, was worried about civil liability. It was not simply because he thought that, or if it, it wasn't because he thought that the court was bound by this particular information. Furthermore, keep in mind that this is not even an affidavit of the defendant. This is an affidavit of defense counsel submitted prior to a prior motion which failed because the defendant did not make that particular allegation that he did not understand. And I would just like to emphasize again that the burden-shifting framework of Banger remains in place even if this court adopts what the state is asking it to do, that is, an allegation with sufficient particularity, namely not just ultimate facts but evidentiary facts as well as to why the defendant did not understand the information. The state respectfully requests that this court reverse the Court of Appeals decision.
Thank you, Ms. Nashold, and thank you, Ms. Swartz, for your argument on this issue. That closes the hearing on 01-0509CR, State versus Corey J. Hampton. The court is in recess until 1:45. Do you want to, would you just give me a few minutes and then bring Abby back? Thank you.